This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to this December 26th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that KZYX brings you the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. The lead up to Christmas offered no respite from the onslaught of news out of Washington. The latest came on Sunday when President Trump pushed up the departure of retired General James Mattis as Defense Secretary and replaced him with his deputy, former Boeing aircraft executive Patrick Shanahan, who the late Senator John McCain described at his confirmation hearing as, quote, putting the fox in charge of the henhouse, end quote. That description, of course, applies to virtually all of Trump's prior cabinet appointees. The resignation of Mattis came as a result of his disagreement with Trump's arbitrary decision, made without consulting him, to withdraw all U.S. forces from Syria in the coming weeks, followed by half of the 14,000 stationed in Afghanistan, actions that he had actually promised during his election campaign, but nevertheless caught Capitol Hill and his U.S. allies completely off guard. That came on the heels of the return of Trump's former national security advisor, General Michael Flynn, to the courtroom, presumably to face sentencing for having lied to the FBI about what had been discussed at a meeting with Russian ambassador and having lobbied for the Turkish government without having registered as a foreign agent, the same charge that had been leveled against Trump, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, who had worked as a paid advocate for the former government of Ukraine without registering with the Justice Department as a foreign agent. From that, one might think that the Foreign Agents Registration Agency takes its duty very seriously, but as can be seen in the most egregious case of American citizens lobbying for a foreign government, namely Israel, the agency and the Justice Department have been missing in action. And that's the hook for the interview you will hear a little later in the program, one that I recorded back in 2013 with James Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. The interview doesn't deal with the subject of foreign agency registration and President Kennedy's difficult relationship with Israel, focusing rather on the details of the assassination and exposing as a fairy tale what was presented to the American people by the That same public was largely unaware that Kennedy was the first and last president who attempted to get the main lobbying group for Israel at that time, the American Zionist Council, or AZC, to register as what it clearly was, an agency working on behalf of the Israeli government. The testimony and evidence presented at two sets of hearings of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1963, headed by Arkansas Senator J.W. Fulbright, made that quite clear, and were it not for the writings of a frequent guest of mine, Grant Smith, director of the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, they might have remained totally submerged beneath the floorboards of American history. As it happened, the lawyers to the American Zionist Council were able to produce legal arguments that enabled the lobbying group to avoid registration and delay it long enough until the assassination of the president made further efforts unnecessary. One result of the hearings was that the American Zionist Council dissolved and reappeared as the Israel lobby we know today, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, with the same staff. Its director, Canadian-born Cy Kennan, had ironically previously registered as a foreign agent for Israel when he was employed by the Jewish Agency, the pre-state organization that laid the groundwork for Israel's establishment. Nothing that Manafort did for Ukraine nor Flynn for Turkey could even begin to remotely match what Kennan and the American Zionist Council and later AIPAC has done for Israel. Flynn's real crime, at least in the eyes of Democrats, I suspect, is an interview he made in Washington in 2015 with Mehdi Hassan of Al Jazeera, in which he not only acknowledged, while head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, that the Obama administration was not only aware of the movement of Al-Qaeda and other Islamic fundamentalists into Syria and their determination to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad, but they supported it, a story that was ignored by the mainstream media, but which I reported to you at the time. A memo he had written at that time confirmed it. Amazingly, journalist Brad Hoff noted at the time, quote, Flynn actually took issue with the way an interviewer, Mehdi Hasan, posed the question. Flynn seemed to want to make it clear that the policies that led to the rise of ISIL were not merely the result of ignorance or looking the other way, but the result of conscious decision-making, end quote. Said Hasan to Flynn, quote, you are basically saying that even in government at the time you knew these groups were around, you saw this analysis and you were arguing against it, but who wasn't listening? I think the administration, Flynn replied. So the administration turned a blind eye to your analysis, asked Hasan. I don't know that they turned a blind eye, replies Flynn. I think it was a decision. I think it was a willful decision. I very much surprised, Hasan then asks, a willful decision to support an insurgency that had Salafist, Al-Qaeda, and the Muslim Brotherhood? It was a willful decision to do what they're doing, was Flynn's rejoinder, end quote. During the interview, Hasan held up a paper copy of the 2012 DIA report, declassified through a Freedom of Information Act request, and read aloud a key passage which noted, quote, there is a possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers of the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime, end quote. Those supporting powers at the time, with at least the acquiescence of Washington, of what would become ISIS, were Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Turkey, and Qatar, and a faction of the Israeli military. A message from Hillary Clinton contained in a batch of papers secured by Judicial Watch in its investigation of her activities regarding the assassination of the U.S. ambassador to Libya in Benghazi, but unrelated to that subject, said that U.S. support of those trying to overthrow Assad was, quote, for Israel, end quote. The bipartisan dismay on Capitol Hill to Trump's announced pullback of U.S. troops from Syria exposed what many critics of Washington have long maintained, and which was succinctly pointed out by Matt Taibbi in the December 23rd issue of Rolling Stone. Nothing unites our political class like the threat of ending our never-ending war, he writes. Trump's decision on Syria and Afghanistan will lay bare the real distinctions in American politics. Political power in this country, he writes, is not divided between right and left, and not even between rich and poor. The real line is between a war party and everyone else. We'll see a lot of hand-wringing today, he writes, from people who call themselves anti-war in 2002 and 2003, but now pray the adults in the room and, quote, keep boots on the ground to preserve credibility. Part of it is because it's Trump, he acknowledges, but a bigger part is we've successfully brainwashed big chunks of the population into thinking it's normal for a country to exist in a state of permanent war, fighting seven countries at once, spending half of its all discretionary funding on defense. It's not, writes Taibbi, it's insane, and will never be a healthy society or truly respected abroad until we stop accepting it as normal. Those observations are from Matt Taibbi from the December 23rd Rolling Stone. I suggest you read the whole article. I'll be dealing at length with this subject in my first program of the new year, January 9th, when I speak once again with U.S. Army Major Danny Scherson, a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan and a prolific critic of Washington's enduring wars. Back in the late 40s and 50s, during the period where House Committee on Un-American Activities and Senator Joe McCarthy held sway, the blacklisted Hollywood writer Albert Maltz wrote a pamphlet entitled Time of the Toad. He began by describing how each morning, before he read the morning newspapers, the French novelist Émile Zola claimed to have eaten a toad. After that, everything else he would read would be palatable. That's how I feel about the New York Times, but having no toads readily available, I forced myself to tolerate the discomfort. As Taibbi mentions elsewhere in his article, the mainstream media is particularly fetid at this moment, portraying to the skies a man who has pushed NATO troops up to Russia's borders, exacerbating the new Cold War, and has routinely sent U.S. warships into China's territorial waters without a peep of criticism from any of the pundits, but the Times reporters and editorial writers are particularly egregious. In Saturday's edition, one of his chief political analysts, David Sanger, wrote favorably how under Mattis and the now-departed National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, quote, dealing with the revisionist powers of Russia and China not containing terrorism was once again the primary objective of national security policy, end quote. Sanger then went on to cite observations on the subject from Robert Kagan, who he described as, quote, a conservative foreign policy expert, end quote, mentioning the books Kagan had written, but ignoring his more significant role as the co-founder with William Kristol of the Project for a New American Century, a pro-Israel, pro-war neocon think tank, which was a foremost advocate for the U.S. war on Iraq before George W. Bush even took office and quietly closed its doors when the war started going badly. Regime change is a family affair with Kagan. His wife, Victoria Nuland, who worked with both for Dick Cheney and Hillary Clinton before being appointed by President Obama as Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia, was instrumental in the coup against Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, in 2014, the ugly details of which I reported on several past programs, since the mainstream media, including the New York Times, chose not to. There were some choice comments also in Saturday's New York Times by Helene Cooper. Quote, over the course of 24 extraordinary hours this week, she wrote, 17 years of military policy was thrown out the window as President Trump spurned his defense secretary's plea to keep U.S. troops in Syria and began the long process of pulling out of Afghanistan, end quote. Nowhere in her article is there any indication that those 17 years represent history of recurring failure. Citing only the opinion of a single serviceman who had served in Iraq, Cooper then came up with this remarkable statement and presented it as if it was a fact. The notion of retrenchment, she wrote, rankled American service members who are used to the idea of an activist American military that promotes freedom and democracy and protects the weak around the world, end quote. Forgive me if for a moment I disagree with Donald Trump, albeit for different reasons, in saying that the mainstream media is the enemy of the people. The New York Times widely considered the paper of record in the U.S. has never found a war it couldn't support or rationalize. All of its support for the 2000 invasion of Iraq was so flawed and dishonest that it later publicly apologized. It is clear it has learned nothing from that experience. If there is any positive takeaway from the inability of the White House to get 60 votes in the Senate to get Trump his border wall, it's that the effort of Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, who is enough to be required to register as an Israeli agent, was unable to include in the budget legislation a measure which would have prevented American businesses from boycotting Israel without paying a hefty fine. The original bill, which was criticized by the ACLU, would have had the heads of businesses that dared to boycott Israel face a jail sentence of up to 20 years and could have been interpreted to apply to individuals who call for boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning of Israel. The ACLU says the modified version would violate our civil liberties as well, and that position was taken by Senator Dianne Feinstein and Bernie Sanders in a letter to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader New York's Chuck Schumer, an Israeli partisan who supports the bill. Feinstein and Sanders wrote, quote, while we do not support the boycotts, divestment, and sanctions movement, we remain resolved to our constitutional oath to defend the right of every American to express their views peacefully without fear or of actual punishment by the government. Finally, right out of Alice in Wonderland, the U.S. has granted Iraq a 90-day waiver from Iran sanctions that will allow it to continue to import electricity from Tehran, its chief supplier, the State Department said Friday. Iraq's power sector is in poor shape and doesn't generate enough electricity to meet domestic demand. The U.S. initially granted Iraq a 45-day waiver in November, allowing it to keep buying electricity and gas from its neighbor while looking for new suppliers. It is now another 90 days in which it can continue importing electricity from Iran, but it is barred from importing gas since doing so would invoke secondary sanctions, penalties for doing business with a sanctioned entity, Iran. Think about that for a moment. Here is the United States, one of whose past presidents, along with his generals, should have been in the dock at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, charged with war crimes for the deaths of close to a million Iraqis and destruction of the country's infrastructure, which instead of paying reparations for the crimes it has committed, has the audacity to threaten his victims with sanctions. You might say it's one of the perks for being indispensable. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.